wish I could break free, back to where I'm supposed to be.
Welcome to the Signals of Noise podcast on the Pro Sound Web podcast network. I am Coach Leonard, joined by Coach Churnside.
Let's go, Kyle. Let's go. Let's go, team.
Oh, my goodness. I just got done coaching 11 6- and 7-year-olds, most of which is their first year playing soccer. My first year coaching soccer. It's an experience. Kyle, you're on the field, what, 7 nights a week, 6 nights a week right now?
6 nights a week between the 2 adult teams I play on and 2 practices and games on the weekend. Yeah, I'm spending a lot of time on the pitch, as they say, across the pond.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's fun. I really it would be really cool if I could like get you out here for like a practice or a game or vice versa, but we'll have to save that for another day, I'm sure. But it's good stuff.
STL D.A. Gray against Chris, Coach Chris's team in PA.
We're the gold team. We're the U8, whatever gold team.
Anyway. Yeah.
you're not even sure of the team name, man.
Well, no, the U, I don't, I would forget whether the U is before or after the A. 8, I'd rather, but whatever, it's semantics. Anyway, let's derailment.
Turned into a soccer podcast.
Yeah. It's another venture. Not happening. Anyway, let's thank some special people. There are some cool news. So as of today of recording, at least, Allen and Heath has dropped 3 new products. It's their CQ line. It's actually a line that they haven't been in before, which is kind of cool. They have a 12-channel, 18-channel, and actually a 20-channel little compact little mixers, like a faderless thing. They would probably not like me saying this, but like, you know, kind of like a Touch Mix or a DM3 type of thing, right? Like, so that range of a thing, right? Let's just be realistic here. You know, it's always I get a kick out of seeing people's initial comments when a new product comes out from no matter where they come out. And my first reaction is like, man, you all are so jaded these days when a new product comes out as to A, what it takes to get a product to market, what the price point, how do you get to that price point, the features that are packed in there. That's all I'm going to say. Anyway, this product looks pretty cool.
Looks real cool.
It looks
full
real
color
cool.
Screen.
Yeah,
full color screen, and
you get the FPGA processing that like the SQ and the DLive stuff has in there. I mean, this thing is going to pack a punch, and I'm literally not saying that just because they sponsor the podcast. I'm like, as a person who actually has to use stuff like this for like AV breakout rooms and small clubs and stuff, this thing is going to be pretty cool. So it's much needed for a point for them. So go check that out. Also, shout out to RCF, loudspeakers. They are going to be demoing at the CFX show in Dallas, which is coming up October 9 through 11 in Dallas. So go check them out there. That's also put on by Live Sound International. And we'll have, there'll be some people we know or who are part of our community who'll be there, and go check it out. So RCF and a bunch of other manufacturers, but specifically RCF, they always do a great job there. And then last but not least, Rational Acoustics, you know, shout out and thanks to them. They have their, you know, if you're listening to this relatively close to when we're putting this out, at the end of September here, at September 21 and 22, they have an advanced operators class up at their headquarters in Woodstock, Connecticut. Thankfully, I was able to do one of these back in 2019 before the pandemic hit. I think I was only like the second or third class to have actually done it because they had just kind of started it in 2019. It's super cool. So if you've gone through some of the other classes, want to take it to the next level and get some more in-person time, like one of the cool things we did, they had like workstations set up at different parts of the campus. And like one room was like a 5.1 movie theater room. And you got to like tune a 5.1 room and do the timings and tunings to that because it's different than your typical live sound stuff. And there's like a troubleshooting room where it's like, hey, we've rewired this amp and speaker or whatever, but using Smart, you need to use that to kind of figure out like what's actually wrong and where is wrong. So like it's deeper level stuff. It's super cool. So yeah, thank you, Alan Heath, RCF, and Rational Acoustics. So
yay.
With all that said, The summer's been crazy. Schedule's been crazy. Had a cancellation. So thankfully, we have brought back. I'm almost about to call you the regular co-host, but anyway. Ryan and John, thank you for hanging out with us again tonight.
And I'm here because I had a cancellation too. My tour canceled the day before it was supposed to fly. It was a little complicated, you know?
That sucks.
It happens.
I've kind of heard that a couple times now that there's been some cancellations starting to happen. I hope this isn't a trend.
Yeah, I'm hoping so too. But yeah, I've seen quite a few last minute cancellations in the past couple months. And, you know, it's an odd thing to deal with, right? And even for someone who's been doing this for a long time, it sucks for me too, right? And if you're new at this, sucks even more, you know? I will say it's really fortunate to have a great network of people. And when this kind of thing happens, I can just reach out and say, hey guys, I'm actually available. I know it's like always a little bit scary to like reach out to people and say, hey, I'm free. Do you know of anything? But nobody knows you're available if you don't tell them, you know? So if this kind of thing happens to you, don't be afraid to say something. And, you know, people will pull out for you. They do. I've gotten a bunch of texts of, hey, would you be able to do this? Would you be able to do that? So it'll work out.
Well, speaking of which, I threw it out last minute because this was a last minute change tonight. Having you on, for a couple questions, maybe from the community. And you're very active in our Discord and Facebook. And also, up front, I want to make sure if people don't know Live Sound Bootcamp podcast, which is also on the Pro Sound Web podcast network that Ryan is one of the hosts of. You guys have a Facebook group. People have been asking. It's been picking up lately, activity in there, which has been fun to see. So if you have questions, maybe channel some over there for Ryan and the team. But anyway, so we asked for questions tonight. And I think one kind of paired along with, you know, a recent experience. I lost my screen. There we go. The question was how to survive on an M32 when you're used to all that high end stuff. You know, you bougie ass Rhino John used to your S6Ls and your Digicos and your whatevers. You know,
your $20,000 rack of lunchbox stuff.
I'm sitting right next to it, looking at it longingly, thinking about the gig I just did. You know.
So you recently had a experience, right? Maybe it's because things fell through. I don't know. Where you went out and did an It's for Lovers festival, which, by the way, is a pretty cool festival series that's been happening. If those don't know, so Hawthorne Heights had an album and a song, Ohio's for Lovers. They've been putting on It's for Lovers festival. It's kind of replacing Warped Tour. You know, another thing that people would probably shoot me for saying, but
Under Oath is on that thing, right? There's a few other bands.
Yeah, not every stop. Yeah, so they're doing, it's kind of like, I mean, this year, It's for Lovers. I think it's almost 10 cities they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's like, them. You know, there's some regulars, everyone, like, of course, Hawthorne Heights. Emery is one that's on all of them. There's some others. But yeah, Under Oath and stuff like that. But anyway, so you got to mix, was it Atreyu you went out and mixed?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's awesome. And it was on an M32, right?
Uh-huh. Yep. And it's what's funny about it is that my last gig was Quantum 5 with, I don't know, three racks of outboard and whatever microphones I wanted and all that. And then this gig was kind of a fill in and help some guys out. So, you know, I toured on the same tour as Atreyu probably like 13, 14 years ago. That's the last time I had seen them.
Yep.
But the front of house guy on their gig left the day before rehearsals were starting for a tour that goes through October. So, you know, a month, not a great scenario. And they just needed someone to come and cover them. I got a call. I said, yeah, you know, I've known you guys forever. I will come and help out. However, until you guys can find someone that'll stay permanent. So, you know, I covered a couple of days for them, but given that it was kind of walking into the scenario where they already had their mic package, they already had their desks, everything was kind of set. It's just come in and make this stuff work. And what they had was, you know, an M32 for monitors that was, you know, set up with a wireless so that they can control it themselves. Mm. And then an M32 at front of house, you know, where the file had not been built at all, right? So I basically met them on the morning of this festival and, you know, figured out getting this stuff together. Now, Pavan was there also helping them out, Kyle, nice. And you know.
Yay, Pavan.
So Pavan had kind of helped them through rehearsal to kind of get it all at least connected together, things reasonably labeled. So he was there in the morning to kind of get it all up and going. But the file for front of house was literally a zeroed console. So I was like, okay, let's get this figured out. Now,
Mix 45 in action.
it was full on Mix 45 in action, except I copied over the monitor file just so things would be labeled, because labeling on an M32, at least if you don't have like a wireless, you know, like a tablet or something, is absolutely miserable to scroll through letters, you know? So I was like, at least I get the labeling, I get the patching. But then from there, I think I only had PA for maybe 2 minutes in the morning. So, you know, we did a sound check, I'll put in air quotes, at 8:30 in the morning, and we weren't playing till 8:30 PM. But in between that, there's like 10 other bands, 10, 15 other bands, whatever. You know, it's, as you said, it's a little bit like Warped Tour. There's a lot of bands and they're sharing backline and things like that. So my sneaky way of getting through this was getting them to do a really quick line check to make sure everything showed up, and then have them play one chorus of one song, and I recorded it. And then I was like, all right, cool. Thanks, guys. Let's let all the other bands go. And while they were setting up the next band, I just switched it into virtual and actually built the mix, because otherwise it was just flat EQs, flat.
Oh, so you at least had your own console sitting there. This wasn't like the house console sitting there.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's you have this upper hand there at least, as opposed to. Yeah.
but this was the desk that Atreyu was going to carry for the rest of the tour.
Okay. So, all right. Yeah. Makes sense.
So it made sense to, you know, build something that whoever comes after me can actually use. And, you know, this is really useful for them moving forward, right? Because,
yeah,
mind you, I've got an SXL here at home, like right behind me. I was had half a mind to be like, you know what, I'm just going to bring this and go do the show. But then I was like, but then whoever takes over the gig after me is not advantaged, and the band is back in the same scenario where they were before. And the goal of this was to get them sorted so that they can move forward, right? But that was my sneaky way of doing it. Okay, cool. I'll record one chorus, and then while they're doing setup for the next band, I can, you know, sit there, dial in gates, dial in comps, dial in EQs or whatever. And I think the funniest thing to me is that, you know, I've been doing audio stuff for ages, and most people these days, when they think of like entry-level audio, you've got the X32, you've got the M32, right? But when those came out, I was already touring Profiles and other desks, so I never learned them properly. I've probably done 4 shows on them ever. So I get to this desk, right? And I'm like, how do you patch outputs? And it's like, it's, to me, it's so backwards, because you pick the output port, like the physical jack, and then route through to where the bus is, which is the opposite of signal flow. Normally you've got the bus and you go, I'm going to go to that physical output. So a lot of little details like that. I'm like tapping guys that are mixing other bands on the shoulder, being like, hey man, do you know how to do this? And they're like, you're here with the headliner, right? And I'm like, yeah, but I don't know how to do this. This was like a funny moment of feeling really dumb. But that said, that desk has everything in it that you need to build a good show, right? It's got gates that sound decent. It's got comps that sound decent. The EQs are effective. It can do bus routing. I mean, there's a lot of fun tricks that, I mean, that I've talked about a million times on my podcast, that I've talked about on your podcast, that are quite challenging to do on that. You know, this sidechain routing and things like that, that's not that easy. But I do truly believe you should be at 95% of your show. You should be like so close to an A+ already before you start doing all those tricks anyways. So at least with like an X32 or an M32, you can get to that 95% and be in a really good spot even without all those extra tricks. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you just record to the USB key?
You can record to the USB key multitrack, which I didn't know. I thought that could only do left, right. So I did plug it into a computer and I just recorded into Reaper. And also, I guess that makes it easier because then I can just loop parts. If you record to the USB, I guess you have to start and then stop and start and stop. So I just made a loop of like this little section of a chorus. And I was like, hey, here's a drum fill. Let me loop the drum fill. Let me get the gates dialed in for the toms. You know, so like at least there's kicks and snares and then the tom hits, so that you can kind of gate out the bleed of the kicks and snares, but make sure your toms come through cleanly. Which, by the way, if people don't already do that, that is the best way to set gates, is to just loop a tom fill that has also kicks and snares, and then just let all your virtual go through. Because then you've got your bleed for snares, you've got your bleed for kicks, but then you have, you know, that tom hits are going to happen. And you don't need the drummer to sit there for 30 minutes just going, boom, 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 you know? But yeah, that was it. Just looped out sections and kind of just kept building on it until it made sense. And then when the band came out, we were like, all right, let's see what happens. That was it.
So did you dial in all your verbs and your delays as well during that time? Yep.
I got a drum verb. I got a vocal verb. I would have gotten a delay up and running, but I was like, I need to go eat. I need to leave. And also some other band had started playing and they're playing at, 100 dBA. And I'm like, my headphones can't win against this. So at this point I can't do anything that's detail oriented. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I basically had the amount of time that that band took to set up was the amount of time I had to build this in headphones.
So imagine this, 2004, 2005, we all had virtual sound check on Warped Tour. How
oh my
fucking
God.
Cool would that be? Because that's literally a throw and go show, and it was Heritage at front of house, like analog desk, and then they switched over to the Midas Digital as well. But just to have a virtual sound check, and that's not very long ago. That's 20 years ago, 15 years ago. So we're talking about the new version of this It's for Lovers. And
yeah,
and this is like the new thing. You can come out of the box and actually just have a show ready to go. It for production staff, wow, that's a significant help. Like those guys from Rat used to wear themselves down every day trying to get sound checks up, trying to get backline up, redialing everything in, charting things. Everybody used to chart,
charting things. I remember when digital cameras came out, I was like, this is the greatest thing. I don't need to chart anymore. And you take five photos of the channel strip instead. And then you'd go back to the digital camera right at line check, or changeover or whatever. And you'd be zooming in on the picture using the little up button going, okay, that's the high EQ. You'd, click down a couple times. Okay. That's the mid EQ. Yeah, that was crazy. We're a little spoiled today,
It is, but you can do that downbeat A+. It's doable. It really is. And how long did you figure you spent doing that?
Probably 20 minutes, which is way more time than you would have ever gotten if you're doing this previously and you were actually doing it on the analog desk, because in that 30-minute changeover, 15 minutes of it is just getting the stuff plugged in and like the amp heads pulled out and all that stuff. I mean, even if you were sharing backline, you'd still somehow eat up half that time.
First thing you did was push all your half faders up for gates and then full faders for comps. And then you're like trying to decide which ones you want because there's only four or whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
Like, so, yeah, and there was some guy standing behind the desk, plugging in inserts.
It's like, where do I patch the insert? Where do I patch the insert? Yeah, number 7, number 12. Yeah.
So a lot of your time from production staff and front of house mixer has been cut in half just because of the digital thing that we're doing now. What I want to ask before we talk about downbeat is using the stuff in the console. And I know this is a big question for everybody because there's a lot of folks out there that M32 is a special desk. That's the desk that they use every day. And what significant difference do you put on stuff in the box? Is it from manufacturer to manufacturer to your outboard gear that you carry or plugins that you use? What's the significant difference that you noticed from doing the Atreyu thing to doing, your last few gigs?
So, every different manufacturer and every desk, as much as we all like to pretend doesn't have a sound, they do, let's say the Yamahas tend to be quite clean. The Midas desks tend to be kind of rounder, right? A little bit more, air quotes, analog sounding, right? Et cetera, et cetera. When you have a desk that is, very kind of pristine and clean, the goal tends to be you use things like plugins or outboard gear to make it less clean. Right. You want to kind of like add saturation, make it, just thicker sounding or whatever it might be without just applying an EQ. Saturation tends to be what helps you there. And a lot of analog gear, the best parts of those pieces of analog gear is the saturation. And then the plugins try to emulate that same thing. Now, specifically doing this gig with this band, the kind of tonality of that M32 is this kind of like analog-y rounder sound. Like it's a little bit, thicker sounding, a little bit meatier sounding. So the compressors aren't necessarily transparent. I'm sure there's a way to make them a bit more transparent, but what I was using for them for on this gig was not to be transparent. I wanted them to sound compressed. I wanted them to sound like, you know, it was a big fat snare drum getting smashed. And that desk, those tools work really, really well for it. The compressors are audible if you choose to make them so, you know, and the EQs tend to be quite heavy-handed, actually. I noticed that, you know, I do like a dB and a half of something, and I'm like, wow, that's a, I really hear that change. Way more so than you do on some other desks. So for the most part, I will start with what's in the desk. And if it's not doing what I really want, that's when I'll look external from the desk, right? And there's additional factors there too, right? Because once you start adding things like plugins or outboard gear, you're starting to add complexity and you're starting to add risk too. And, you know, obviously some systems are very stable with plugins and all that stuff, but like there are additional connections to be made. There's more stuff to be plugged in every day. And if I'm trying to build a show that gets handed off to someone else, I want to make it reasonably simple so that they don't have to, you know, load up a bunch of other stuff, connect a bunch of other stuff to make this go. So what's funny is when I handed this gig off to the guy who's taking over for the rest of this tour, one of the first things he did was pull up a bunch of stuff in, I guess I would call it the premium rack, because in the Yamaha world, that's what it's called, right? Premium rack. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that you could actually run, I don't know, Midas plugin type things, like an 1176 plugin and a LA2 type plugin in it. I didn't even know you could do that. Had I known you could do that from the start, maybe I would have.
Right.
But I think this goes to like, this goes back to the conversation and a couple weeks ago, we're talking about, you know, the analog comparison you did in the box comparison. And, you know, and look, the general summation of that was that, like, look, you can get 90, 95% there with whatever tool you have in front of you, or maybe that, or I should say that should be the goal of like whatever you have to work with, you should be able to get it there. And these extra things are tools to take it to another level, you know, or for the right reason or for the right sauce. And so like I think we live in a day and age, we've all kind of agreed that like you should be able to get, no matter the level of the show, the type of, you know, experience or whatever, you should be able to get 90 some percent really acceptable on whatever console in the box thing. And then anything beyond that, let's be honest, half the times the stuff we're doing is more for us or for the artist or whatever. It's that gravy, it's that sprinkle, it's that fairy dust on top, right? Would you agree? Or
yeah well, also one other thing to kind of point out though is that like there's a time to quality metric there, you know, like how much extra time are you going to spend to get 2% better quality, right? And in some scenarios, you don't have that extra time. So it's like, great, I could instantiate this plugin or this, you know, premium effect thing and get it dialed to utter perfection. But by doing that, I'm taking away time from, I don't know, the rest of the channels that may be just as important or more important.
Yeah.
Right. And especially if you start at the bottom of the input list, and let's be real, everyone's input list starts with drums and then it goes through bass, guitars, you know, we all kind of go in that order. And vocals are kind of at the end. They tend to be. And if you go in that order, you're taking time away from vocal by, you know, putting plugins and this and that on the stuff before it. And at the end of the day, vocal is probably more important than that plugin you're going to put on, you know, your hi-hat.
Yes.
Yeah, very much sure. So
yeah, you know, just choose appropriately where to spend the most of your time, you know. So I would suggest get 90% of the mix as quick as you can, you know, as fast as you can, and then you go, okay, cool, these are the last 10% things I need to do, but I already have something that's acceptable, so if I had to go out the gate with this, we'd be okay, but I'm going to keep working on those last 10% things, you know.
Yeah, no, see, it's funny you say that. And so we had John Huntington on last week, and one of the things that we greased on that we want to circle back on is the concert goer's Bill of Rights that he had kind of written. And we intend on coming back to this, but I'm going to read him off real quick because this is actually good. Please. Advice in this scenario, of especially on a festival level thing where it's throw and go or whatever, right? Number one, for the record, these are like his thoughts. He's trying to keep them simple and clear, right? So as the audience at a concert, here's your Bill of Rights. You should be able to understand the words, right? So that's number one. You should be able to clearly hear...
With metalcore, even if the vocal's clear, you still sometimes can't understand it. But yeah.
Yeah, there's some genre things in here that may not play into this. Yeah. But, and again, his words, not mine. But you should be able to clearly hear every instrument and sound source on stage. You should not have to endure painful levels or have your hearing damaged. And you should get decent sound no matter where you are sitting or standing. That one, you know, depending on a few things, we've talked about how maybe intentionally there's spaces of a venue that are intentionally quiet or cool, but by yep. and large, if you bought a ticket to an experience, you should experience the same thing. So anyway, but all that to say, like, I think those are actually, when I read this, I was like, man, that's pretty good rules to live by when we're talking about, like, festival, throw and goes, whatever. Like, you keep these couple things in check, and you're going to kind of steer the ship.
Yeah, yeah.
So from the audio guy perspective... It's fun to think. I'm not one that says any brand of console, the onboard stuff is unusable. Like, I think manipulating them enough, there's not, I mean, I've had everything from Personas to Digico as well. And like, there's nothing, especially when that's at my fingertips, that you can't manipulate enough to work at this day and age. Like, yeah. It's almost like speaker boxes. Like, they're almost so good now that it doesn't matter. Like, throw a bunch of them up and go. I mean,
I agree with you a million percent.
Is there a console, or have you ever got on a console and you're like, this is unacceptable for a compressor or a gate? Like, I don't think I've ever said that. I mean, we used to have those the ACP-88s, the Personas thing. And
every club
those things
in the
sounded
US.
Terrible, but they got the job done.
And there was eight of them. Holy cow. Like, score. There's all your drums
there. And what, two RU, right? Two RU, you got eight of them. It was great. And they were cheap.
But I've heard people say that where they're like, oh, the gates or comps on this desk is just, that's unacceptable. They're unacceptable. Like, what makes them unacceptable?
I mean,
the user who can't use it properly.
You know what does make things hard is the user interface for things, though, right? Because
correct.
And the defaults. The defaults go a long way to make something easy to use or hard to use, right? So if you grab a gate, first thing you're going to get is a threshold, right? Like, no doubt, that's the first control you're going to grab. And if you pull that to somewhere and the whole rest of the gate sounds like crap because the default settings for the rest of it don't really align with your standard usage, you're going to be like, what the fuck? And then you're going to be spending time to try and kind of find your way back to that mental place you were when you grabbed that threshold.
Starting point.
Whereas
if the
defaults are actually pretty good, then you grab that threshold and you're like, all right, cool. It did mostly what I thought it was going to do. Now I'm just going to, you know, tail of the release. Like, it's less of a jarring experience. And that's the same for comps. And it's the same for EQs. You know, there are some desks where the EQ default, I grab a frequency and do a thing. And I'm like, that does not sound like it did what I thought it was going to do. And it's because of some of the settings that are in that EQ. And if you just change it to a different setting, you're like, oh, now it does exactly what I thought it was going to do. So defaults... can be a thing that really change the way you work with some of your tools. And like some of these things, until someone tells you, like, try this preset and this thing and this option, I don't think some of those things you'd ever find on your own.
That's fair.
I'm trying to say that like very amicably.
Yeah, I don't want to get you in trouble. So what's not name names. Sticking in this theme, you know, throw and goes. One of the questions was, how do you approach doing multiple bands one after another in a mini festival? So there's a lot of questions there. Context. So let's just assume you're like the only front of house guy, regional festival thing, the only front of house guy or girl, and like none of the acts have brought a band. And you're on the same console for the next four bands. You didn't have sound checks, right? It's line check and go. That's the only way I can read this in that context.
Yeah, yeah.
What would be your approach to doing that?
So there's kind of two ways that this goes. And one is what Kyle was talking about earlier, like the way, you know, the Warped Tours and those festivals used to be, right? It'd be a big analog desk. And you had, you know, a couple kick channels, a couple snare channels, a couple toms, et cetera. And you'd pin everyone into the hole that was the appropriate hole for what they had on stage, right? So if a band had two guitar players, cool, you already had two guitar faders available. If they had one guitar player, you just ignore the other one. you know, ignore the other fader, that is, right?
Yep.
And when you do that, as your day goes on, you kind of start getting your EQs tailored to, you know, the first band plays, you get your kick, your snare, your this, your that. And then when the second band plays, you're already starting there where you ended, right? So you tend to kind of get better and better as the day goes on. So I haven't done that in, I can't even think of how long. It's been a long, long time. But in the digital world, there's a gig I used to do called Undercover. And this used to happen in San Francisco. And what they do is they pick like an iconic album, for example, like Radiohead's Kid A or like Lauryn Hill's Miseducation of Lauryn Hill. And one band would play each song from the record. So, for example, Kid A, what is it? 16 cool. songs. That meant 16 bands in a day. And it was really rad. But like you can imagine how complicated that would be, right? Because each band may not even be the same genre. So it might be, I don't know, like a hardcore band for the first one, jazz band for the second one, like salsa band for the third one, you know, like it was kind of all over the place. So when doing that, what made it work was all the prep work in advance, right? Now, in the context of this question, you know, if you're the guy or girl that is sitting in front of a house that's about to do a festival with 14 bands, you definitely didn't get all the input lists in advance. There's no way you did, because that's how this shit
and
goes.
And if you did,
right?
They were probably all wrong.
Exactly. And if you did, exactly. They actually had 16 more channels. You know what I mean? But you can somewhat guess what you're going to run into. And you can put a bunch of extra channels in there being like, you know, just in case they have four keyboards, let's put four stereo keyboard channels here and we'll leave holes, right? Because inevitably someone's going to show up with something that doesn't fit into your input list. And maybe they don't show up with four keyboards, but they show up with two and two DJs. Well, throw the DJs in the keyboard lines, you know, and you'll be okay. But in the digital realm, the idea is kind of the same, right? You kind of build out this thing that is way more channels than you're ever going to need for a single band, but all the inputs are kind of there for anything you might run into. And when we did this Undercover thing, we would have an input list that was probably like 130 channels. Because it was just all sorts of crazy stuff. Because a couple bands had like string players. A couple bands had, you know, a 12-person choir, like crazy stuff. But you'd lay it all out into this input list. And then what I would do is I would take any of the band input lists that got sent to me and put it in an Excel sheet. So along the left, or rather Y-axis, was all the inputs we had that we had built into our input list. Along the X-axis was each band's name. And I'd put an X as to whether or not they were using those inputs. Right. So this band's got two kick drums. Great. An X on kick one, X on kick two. They have two snare drums, X on snare one, X on snare two, et cetera, et cetera, all the way down. And if another band wasn't using that, I would not put the X's there. Right. So then at that point, you know, you get that first band up there, you kind of get your EQs for those channels. And then I'd go to a custom fader layout. And on that custom fader layout, I'd look at that chart and go, I need that fader, that fader, that fader, that fader, that fader, and ignore all the other ones. Right. So then when they'd come up and play, you'd pull those things up, you'd get a rough balance. And the same way you'd build way too many inputs, you'd build too many effects chains as well. So you'd have, you know, four reverb sends, you know, one maybe is percussion, one is, I don't know, instruments, one is like vocal, one is background vocal, probably more than four. And, you know, bunch of extra delayed lines, bunch of extra things. You have way more than you'd need so that theoretically, you can kind of set up something short, something long, something else short, something else long for different instrument types. And then all you have to do is spin up the send rather than rebuild a new effects patch for each of them. And then at that point, you just save a snapshot for each of them. And that snapshot realistically is fader levels and send levels and pretty much nothing else. Because the rest of it, as I said, like in the analog realm, you're going to kind of get better as the day goes on. And that, to me, was the way to work through doing 16 bands in a one-hour show, which is crazy, but, you know,
ta-da.
It's kind of how you do it. I don't know. I mean, Kyle, no, you've kind of done this too. Do you have
– I mean, I've done the festival as well. I mean, like, to me, like, the number one thing I've always told people is that, like, you know, first off, the thing that you can always guess or know ahead of time is high-pass filters, right? So you can never go wrong with at least just starting your high-pass filters on all your inputs, right, and pushing up faders, right? Like, and you typically have a general sense of gain structure of, like, okay, I expect the vocal to be maybe here minus 30 or something like that, or whatever console you're working on in the context of, you know. But, like, you can typically get a safe starting point on gain structure. High-pass filters are safe. And at the end of the day, I think this, as you were talking about this, this kind of goes back to the Bill of Rights on the, like on these things. Like, look, at the end of the day, you're not trying to print an album on these festivals, right? You're trying to deliver an experience, make sure A, you know, people's vocals are heard and what's being played on stage is being reproduced at a reasonably even level. So it's not worth getting caught up in, you know, double bussing your drums and your snare and parallel compression and like all these things, right? That's the least of your worries, you know, I would think in those scenarios.
Festival
style. No, I mean, I agree 1,000,000%. I agree 1,000,000%. And, you know, even if you're in a scenario where you don't have, I don't know, custom layouts, just assign things to VCAs in groups of, you know, keys, guitars, et cetera. And then your actual input faders only pull up the ones you need and then use those. Your most powerful tool in that kind of scenario is going to be your fader, period. Compressors almost don't matter. You know, your EQs, they're going to be a bit of a mess. You're going to have to kind of catch them during the first song of that band. But your faders and the balance that you build is kind of everything. And also start out of the gate a little low. Always start low and kind of bring it up. Because if you start too hot, it feels so wrong to turn it down.
Same with the compressors, but the threshold.
That's a part of the day that I work with my monitor engineer. Whoever's doing monitors, I work with them because they started vocals. And whether they're using ears or wedges for the day, they'll go and set all their vocals. So if we have like six vocals patched, we'll just go through all six, set them all the same, and do your high pass and go. Like you were talking, you know, we spend a lot of time working from one to the end of the input, which is our vocals. But on festival days and days that you have quick sound checks, the first thing that you get up in the PA is vocals, period. No matter what end of the snake you're on, that's what you're going to be listening to, you know?
And communication on stage for the next steps.
Exactly what I was about to say. Sure. It's like, if you don't have that up, you can't communicate what you're doing anyways.
Yep.
Because usually you don't know the artist. They're kind of talking through their vocal mic, that kind of thing. It just becomes a thing. Now, that said, though, if you've got those festivals where it's like you have to build everything in headphones because there's another stage playing and you can't put anything through the PA, that's tough, too. I mean, the tips for that is, you know, you need to have a set of cans that you know and trust. It's never going to translate to PA exactly the same way. But if you are used to what these headphones sound like and you're like, okay, this kind of thing sounds harsh in these headphones every time I use them, then at least you have some sort of level reference. And then when you get to putting it through the PA, get your faders in the right place. And then the next step for you should be going to your master EQ on your master bus to do tonality shifts to get your PA in line. After that, go and start working on all the details.
Interestingly enough, Lee Fields had made a post. It got me to thinking. He's like, I'm convinced the most important skill you can possess to be a great live sound mixer is knowing the songs you are mixing. Deeper you know the songs, the better the mix will be. And of course, we can get esoteric with this or you know, granular in terms of other sound things. But like from a mix standpoint, right, a mix engineer, I think this is interesting. Some people added some fodder to this of like at least knowing the genre, you know. So like I think to tie this into like the festival side of things, like, sure, if you're on a metalcore show and your daily grind is jazz, R&B, something else, you're going to be in for a rough day. Right, like, you know, like it's just and I think it was you, Ryan, who said this on one of your Livestock Bootcamp ones. It's like or maybe it's ours, I don't know. Not only knowing the artist that you're listening to, but like putting on like the shuffle of like that artist's genre, the ones that are around it will help shape. So, you know, the people who experience this type of music, art or whatever, what they're expecting around. Yeah. Was it you that had said something about that?
Yeah. I had said something like that. But you know, whenever I work for a new artist, the first thing I ask for is, you know, what's your set list? And if you don't know the set list, what's the set list from your last tour? I want to have some rough idea. And I go studying. And then between then and when the gig happens, that's all I'm listening to is the set list, right? Now, they'll throw in some new songs and all that, but you get a good idea of the vibe. And I remember when I used to work in venues, I'd find out, oh, okay, well, you're on this night. Oh, these are the three acts that are playing. I would just pull them up on, you know, iTunes, Spotify. At the time, I think you have to pull them up on YouTube because I'm not sure either of those existed. But still, you can listen to it and go, okay, cool. This is like what this music feels like in general, or rather on their records at least. Now, not everyone wants their record to be what's translated live.
Sure.
But at least if you learn what's on their record, you get an idea of like what they're trying to present to an audience.
Is this guitar driven? Is this piano driven? Is this, is kick supposed to destroy you or no? You know, is it supposed to sound like an 808 or is it supposed to sound like a cardboard box? You know, because there's a difference, right? Like I've said this before, I'll say it again. Like I'll never forget, early on doing a lot of R&B tours and I got a lot of shit because it's like, dude, your kick drum sounds like a rock kick drum. That's not what our kick drum sounds like, right? They're not the same thing.
But yeah, studying up, I mean, that's hugely, hugely valuable because again, you know, a lot of that is about balance. I mean, as you just said, right? Is this guitar driven or is this keys driven or is this something else driven? Is the vocal supposed to be way on top or do you actually tuck it in? Because in this example, metalcore, it's pretty much always tucked in. Most of those bands are guitar and vocal driven, and those are the most important things, you know?
For sure.
I had that experience on this last run with Max. He was playing a new song, Strings, and I had never heard the recorded version because he was waiting on a couple features to go on it, and I had never heard it. The day that dropped, I mixed that song completely different the next day because it was recorded as a track, but he plays with a live band. So now I understood what his vision was for the song. Let's just say before I listened to the song, I'd mix it more like a strings, like a nice little string song. But in the recorded version, it's more like a Jersey House dance version. Just the way the bass sits and stuff and where the kick drum is and how it drives the beat, you know, drives. And I was like, holy cow. If I wouldn't have heard that recorded version, I would have mixed it completely wrong forever, really. And it does help out, man, because then you get, oh, now I could find what we're doing here. This is a good idea.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really helps to study.
So let's go a different direction. Another question was, I have passions in both audio and programming. How did Ryan get into designing SXL? And how do you have any advice for someone who may want to dig down that path?
So how I got into it is not what I would advise people, but I do have advice separately. So years and years and years ago, viruses started showing up on profiles and SC48s. I imagine you guys maybe remember this. You'd get these little like screens that would pop up in the middle that said, I don't know, like DH error or something like that. And I remember emailing the Avid support team being like, hey, here's the file that shows up and here's the file that's on the keys. Like, you know, maybe this will help you guys figure this out. And from there, we kind of stayed in touch, you know, like 8-9 years later or whatever it may have been. I guess somebody had told them like, oh, you know, Ryan doesn't really want to be doing touring anymore. And we had been emailing back and forth for years about just random little things. So they said, well, would you be interested in product management? I was like, I don't know what that is because nobody knows what product management is unless you work in product. Everyone knows what product design is. They just don't know the rest of it.
Right.
So anyways, that, you know, long, long, long story short. Yeah, I interviewed for that position the whole time being like, there's no way they're going to hire me. You know, they'd ask me all these questions like, do you know anything about, managing teams? And I'm like, kind of. Like, do you know anything about, doing business cases? Yeah, kind of, but no. You know, like all my answers were like basically no.
Well, have we got a job for you?
Exactly. So I was like, there's no way they're going to give me this job. And when you have no pressure, you definitely don't think you're going to get it. You have fun, right? So I just had like all this fun on these job interviews. I was being really real with everybody and like very comfortable. Anyways, clearly it worked out. Ended up working with them for years, designing a platform and all that. And it was awesome. That is not a common path to get into doing this right now. Since then, I've worked for other manufacturers, and I've even done hiring for developers for manufacturers. And the hardest thing for a manufacturer to find is a developer that, you know, one, is good at whatever, you know, language they're, you know, trying to hire for, but two, actually understands the product use. So if you want to work in development for audio products, reach out to the companies because they need you. Because the people that apply for the jobs are just generic developers, for the most part, that know the code base, but have no idea how a customer is going to use this product. So having that extra bit of information is incredibly valuable. And, you know, even in hiring, we'd be going through resumes, we'd be going through things. Anyone who actually had audio experience went to the top of the list. It's like, great. Mm-hmm. They'll at least know what an EQ is supposed to do. You know, they'll at least know what the, you know, the gate goes before the compressor in a standard signal flow, you know, like stuff like that. Whereas other people, you have to walk them through everything. And even if they're amazing coders, very often you have to double check their work in a kind of user focused way, because they can't necessarily do that themselves because they don't understand the workflows. So if you want to get into doing that, literally reach out to manufacturers. If they have job postings, apply directly. If they don't, see if there's someone within those, you know, teams that you can reach. You know, everyone's on LinkedIn and it says their job positions. You know, most people are on Facebook, but they potentially don't put their job positions there. Don't use Instagram or anything like that. But LinkedIn does kind of cover everyone's access. And if you reach out to them, they will keep your information. They absolutely will, because it is that hard to find developers that know how to use these products. It really is.
I think that's one of the most interesting things that I've learned in being involved with Signals to Noise in the last 4 years or so, is the manufacturer side of our industry. The amount of possibilities and avenues there is insane. And the number one thread you had kind of said is like, just like say something, right? Like just be in contact with, if there's gear that you like, or people that you like within our industry, talk to them, share your experiences, because you never know where the opportunity is going. Even if you think, you don't think you have any desire to work with a manufacturer, who knows what that relationship could look like, of just, I don't know, being a beta tester, or a trainer. Right. Like and that's, so we've talked about this a lot, but it's just funny how it keeps coming up, of like so many things in the last decade for myself have come from just having a conversation with the people that I cared about or just was interested in or whatever. And then things just kind of fall into place. It, like you said, it wasn't like this like pursued path. It just kind of comes to it. As long as you just continue to build these kind of networking things, you know, the right people will rise to the right networking groups and propel from there.
You know, along those same lines, though, it's exactly the same as networking to get a gig, right? Yep. You don't reach out and go, hey, I need something from you, which happens a lot, right? Like, people will message me like, hey, you know, if you know of any gigs, you know, can you put me on them? I'm like, cool. I don't really know you, so I can't go there yet. But when you reach out to them, offer them something. And it doesn't have to be, you know, I don't mean like gifts or anything like that, but, you know, offer insight or you know, be the person that they want to talk to, not be the person that feels annoying to talk to. Don't go,
yes,
hey, I want to work for you guys. Here's my resume. Give me a job. You go, I'm interested in doing development for this type of product. You know, this is some of my experience. What do you think is a good path forward? Everyone loves to, you know, give you knowledge, right? It makes them feel empowered. It makes them feel like they know more than you do, right? It's like totally an ego thing. When you ask people a question and they answer, I mean, hell, I love being on this podcast with you because it makes me feel like I'm really smart. I'm like, oh man, you guys ask me questions. You think I have valuable information. But it's exactly that. If you can make someone feel like, you know, they are not burdened by your question or your email, it will go way farther than, you know, sending a resume saying, hey, I want a job. That doesn't work.
Yeah.
So, and it's the same for gigs, right? It's the same. So, because it's the same type of people that are in these roles. Like, nobody works in pro audio because they love, I don't know, cameras. They work in pro audio because this is what they love to do. There are other jobs they could do that they'll make way more money. Go work for Google. You'll make way more money. But you do this because you love it and you want people to work with you that also love it. So that kind of stuff works. Show the love when you reach out.
Yeah, and let's flash back, Chris.
Go ahead.
Let's flash back to the Kenny Barnwell episode when he talked about the hiring circle. And as soon as Ryan started talking about that, it reminded me. And this is for any job that you really want. First, they check with their inner circle of people that they work directly with. If they can't do it, they check with the friends of the inner circle. Yeah. And if the friends can't get it, then it goes to the internet. Something may be wrong. Something may be weird. It might be filled. They just had to put that up. Like I've heard that a lot where people put the job up, but it's already filled internally or through someone else. But legality, they have to put it up. Just remember that when you're getting hired, like the closer that you can get with an inner circle of folks that you want to work with, or that's your kind of quality of thing, like that's where you're going to get hired. And as audio mixers like ourselves, like Ryan said, a lot of those people at the company have never flown a PA. They've never packed a truck. Mm. They've never lined out a stage. They've never worked a mic stand in between sets. You know what I mean? Like these are all new things to them. So everybody from stand manufacturers to big boxes that hang in the sky are recording consoles or mixing consoles. Like they need us to show them workflow and how we do our job at this point. And you're like a treasured employee at that time. Like I did it for Midas and I did it for Bose and I've done, you know, some other things too. And those people were super smart, but they weren't super smart at doing this part of the job. Like, oh, the fly hardware is wrong. Oh, when you reach here, you can't be reaching for, like you said, preset or what your default setting is just doesn't work out of the box. Like the manufacturers cherish that information. So that's your way in. And then the second part would be the Kenny Barnwell trade shows network, you know, go meet people at the booths. You know, probably some of the best friends you'll ever meet will be at trade show booths and, they'll help you out in the future for sure.
You know, it's a great tip though, when you go to trade shows, first off, do not have dark colored business cards because you can't write shit on them, but have light colored business cards. And when you give it to someone, write a note on the back of what you talked about when you spoke to them. Mm. Then when you hand it to them, they will remember who you are. I come back from trade shows sometimes with like 60 cards. And I'm like, I don't remember who any of these people are. Like I'm like, I know I had conversations with all these people, but so many of them don't have context. And I'm like, so I'm pretty sure someone told me that as a tip a long time ago. And I think since then, almost every business card I would hand out, I got an email or a call back because some context of how we met and what we talked about was written on there. And sometimes it has nothing to do with audio. Sometimes it's like, oh yeah, we talked about that, you know, 67 Les Paul that I found at a garage sale. And that's what it'll be on the back. And then, you know, hand it to someone, you know, or, but whatever makes you more memorable than an ocean of people that is also trying to do the same thing. Yeah, it's really helpful.
No, and I know we're kind of talking about this in a job context, but like this still applies that even if it's not just from a job context, right? Just like having relationships with manufacturers, other engineers, when you just need support or a help or advice or whatever. Yeah, at the end of the day, I think it just comes down to, I don't know, just, you know, circling on the networking thing. But
yeah, you know, the other thing is if you've got support reps that you contact somewhat regularly, hit them up sometimes when you're not asking for something too.
Mm.
You know,
yeah,
see how they're doing. Be a human being. It really, really helps. I don't mean that in a mean way, but like I get it. You know, we hit up support when there's a problem, but very often we don't remember to appreciate that they've solved so many problems for us.
Sure.
And they remember to, you know, be extra helpful for the people that actually treat them like a human being in those extra times. It's super valuable.
Very
it's not
valuable.
That hard to do, but super valuable.
I have a whole laundry list of people that I talk to on a normal basis that I was just support for. And the first thing they ask is like, hey, how's the kids? How's the ladies? What's going on? Like it. And those people are super invaluable because they've called me for gigs. They've found stuff for me in certain cities that I couldn't find things and I had to hit up, like, so it's very reciprocal at that point. And you will find the good ones. There's good ones. And then the other thing about trade shows, I never noticed this until I started working for a manufacturer, is, the turnover rate of a typical sales type position is very fast. So like 3 to 5 years, possibly, they'll be wearing one polo and then the next time you see them, they'll wear another one. So these are great connections to have because they know how to get the job in the industry. Like they know how to perpetuate what their return on investment is for their company. And, it's just something you watch out for at trade shows, because like half the people I started with already went through three companies, and
yeah,
you know, they've helped me out with every single one, which is great.
Certainly. And so the most important part there is that you never know who you're going to need when, or connections. So don't be an asshole. Don't piss people off. Like, you know, that's one thing being the host of like the CFX loudspeaker demo, or the way we did at NAMM and stuff. It was actually really cool to see the different manufacturers, like all of the, whether they were a product person or a salesperson or whatever from each of the companies, like, there was still a level of camaraderie across all of them, where it could have been like this, oh, I'm with X company, you're with X company, F you type of,
right.
It wasn't like that. Like, you know, they gave their presentation. When the presentation's done, everyone's hanging out. Everyone's talking about each other's products, all the, you know what I mean? Like, it's, we're people, you know? So that was refreshing to kind of see over the past couple of years, like that side of it.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Let's wrap up with this. So Ryan, short of looking for another gig right now,
He's going to coach soccer. We've talked him into it.
Oh, come on. I know. Yeah. Both you guys are doing it. I got to join in. I don't have my own kids though. I'll just be coaching other people's kids. That'll be weird.
What's something that you're working on or want to work on next for you? What's, you know, you did this analog comparison, you've been trying to pour your heart out into the lifestyle bootcamp thing. Like, what are you, either personally, business wise whatever, what are you working on next?
Oh man, that's a tough question.
Driving cars,
you know,
really
at
fast.
Some point. Well, yeah, I actually have been doing that a lot.
Yes, there it is.
That's what I do on my days off. I do that on my days off, or I go go-karting if I can.
Yes.
Which I love doing on tour, going go-karting with the tour, because it gets everyone together. Everyone gets competitive. It gets so much fun. Make sure no one gets hurt, though, because that sucks.
Have you ever done whirly ball in Chicago? Have you done that?
No. No, what's that?
Kyle, do you know what whirly ball is?
I do not.
Oh, I think it still exists. I should Google this. There's this place in Chicago. I think they may have changed this. But all right. So you know the bumper cars where it's like the single joystick where like you have to you turn one way it's forward, the other way it's backwards, or whatever, right?
Yep.
So they have those bumper cars. It's in like a basketball court. There's a there's a basketball net at either end with just a hole in the backboard, right? No net. And you have a high lie stick, which is like, you know, like the half sickle stick and a ball, right?
Yeah.
And you drive around with bumper cars, passing off high lie balls, trying to score into the opposing nets on either end. So it's like a 5-1-5 or whatever, like bumper car with high lie stick, you know. And on top of that, there is a bar there as well. So there's a couple of these courts and a bar. So you go maybe have a few libations and then go get in these carts and play whirly ball, as it's called. We literally did the whole like roll up in a tour bus. Everyone gets out of the tour bus. We all go inside. And so I don't know if it still exists, but it was in Chicago. Anyway, that we said go-karts made me think of it. So
that,
good stuff.
That actually sounds really awesome. I'll have to look that up when I go out that way next. But it's a tough question to answer because, yeah, great. I love driving cars fast and all, but that's like it's very much like a me doing by myself thing. The stuff that really fulfills me is doing stuff with other people or for other people. You know, so going out and doing this gig with Atreyu to kind of help him out of a tough spot felt really, really good. And I remember years ago, I tried to kind of do this thing where I would, go with an artist and build the show with them during rehearsal and then kind of send it out with somebody else. The same way lighting designers do. You know, they design a show and then someone else goes, takes it out. Is that a video of...
Did you find whirly ball? Does it exist?
Oh my God, you found a video of this? It looks amazing.
Yes.
But I was trying to do the same thing that lighting designers do, where it's basically like build and design a show and then send it out with someone else. And kind of doing that on this Atreyu gig was really fulfilling. Like, built the show, but then also had a guy who is a lot fresher at doing this than I am come and sit with me for a whole day. And we talked through everything that, you know, related to how this was built, why it was built, et cetera, et cetera. And then he goes off and does the show. I actually think I want to try and do that a little bit more, and not necessarily as a like build shows and, you know, collect revenue on, you know, shows that are out, but rather partially as a training thing. So it's like, cool, there's a band who's got an engineer and we want to sit together and build the best possible show they can build and sit and do that with them for a couple of days through rehearsal and then send them out on their way and see how it goes and just check in every couple of weeks, you know? Because to me, that's like a fun way of being mentor, but also being still part of the art and all that, you know?
I'm going to hire you for this next run then. Let's go.
No, I think it'd be great fun. I would love to do it.
What I like about it though is it strips a certain amount of like ego out of the work that someone might put into something, right? Like, you know, because at the end of the day, you know, it's not going to be you behind that console, but you're trying to impart, you know, some knowledge and create an experience and a next level for somebody. So I think that's a whole nother next level, like mentorship thing, you know, but while still getting your dues, if you will, of like, you know, people caring for your time, you know.
Right. I mean, I'll be honest, you can't do it for free, but in some ways it is a really cheap education to jump forward a couple steps, depending on who it is, right? And I've done it actually a couple times in the past 6 months. And like every single time I've done it, I'm like, this is really, really fulfilling. Like for me, it felt good. Because I like teaching, right? And obviously the Live Sound Bootcamp. Like, it's really, really fulfilling for me to do that.
You know what I wonder if it's possible? I wonder if it's possible for you to get in with some labels. So, like, if you were to contact some record labels and be like, all right, we know we have this up-and-coming artist who's about to explode, you know, and often some of these upcoming artists maybe have, you know, some engineers that are maybe kind of coming out of the club scene, haven't toured, haven't done the next level type of thing. And so that record label is looking to extend their brand and get the artists out, stuff like that. I mean, that may be an angle to get more of those short of just an engineer. And the reason I say that is because, you know, the engineers reaching out may not have the funds to be able to have you do that. Whereas like a label or a band might,
Do you know who needs that? Needs that? I got a whole genre that needs that. K-pop, because it's very manufactured and it's really cool music, but I think at the live in translation part of it is where it needs the guy, the girl to do it, like the spot. Like, so what I was thinking when you said that is I have a lot of electric drums on an album, so I would have you come in and help me figure out how I could emulate some of those sounds that I wouldn't be normally typically like trying to mess with because that would be cool. That's why I said, let's go, let's do this. I like this idea because
it's a sound designer.
Yeah. For
touring. I mean, sound that's designer. Kind of what it is. Kinda. Yeah.
I think it would be great fun. Go ahead.
But just like picking the rack and picking, helping with microphone selection and like talking about that with somebody sitting right next to you, that holy cow, like that is an awesome idea. I like this idea a lot. I will be the guinea pig.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll figure out a way to make this into a real thing. And honestly, I don't think I'm like the bee's knees of engineers, but there's a bunch of other guys who I'm like, we should learn from them. We should learn from them. We should learn from them.
Yeah. But that's the thing is like, I think it's not about being the bee's knees, right? It's about you have experience both in, you know, multi-genres, you know, high levels, at the end of the day, when it comes to mentorship of these things, it's like you've at least experienced a thing that you can then translate, you know, and it doesn't have to be, you know,
And to be honest, it's two-way anyways, because I'm going to learn a bunch too.
Right. Exactly. 100%.
And that's the collaboration part of it is the best part. Like, two people can mix the same band absolutely completely different. Mm-hmm. And to be able to hear what comes out of two people's versions of that, the collab, the version in the middle is probably going to be something special. It really is. And that's why I think the sound design part of that that's huge, man, because then even if one had a one up on like drums or one had one up on instrumentation or track or layering or whatever the case may be, putting that all together into the best version of that. Whoa. That's pretty neat idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I just think it would be super fulfilling for a lot of people. And I, you know, if we can elevate audio as a whole, to just be better in the world, I think it would be awesome.
That's what we're trying to do.
but I have to tell you a story now that you mentioned it, Kyle. You know, K-pop. I went and did a bunch of stuff with Blackpink while they're doing their rehearsals.
Awesome.
And
guilty pleasure.
It blew my mind how awesome the way the rehearsals ran. So I just have to walk through this because this is just so cool. So, you know, rehearsals, I had ears mixes up or whatever. So everyone's getting their own ears mixed. And there was an MD in the room that had, you know, keyboard, little studio monitors and stuff like that. And I'm basically just going to walk through how they rehearsed because this was just so insightful and cool to me. So the band didn't know a song. So what the MD would do was just play the album, right? And he would just play it on that one song on loop for 15 minutes. And everyone is noodling. And they're basically listening to only themselves and the album, right? So no one needs to listen to everyone else's noodle. Right. So at that point, that goes for 15 minutes. At the end of 15 minutes, you know, it stops and goes, cool. Everyone comfortable with their parts? Yes. All right, cool. Now the monitor mixes flip so that everyone's listening to, you know, each other, and they play through the song. Now, I also have a board mix feed that is feeding back to the MD that is recording into his session. So while they're playing the song, it's recording into the session in real time. Right. And as soon as they're done playing the song, they all come and sit in the sofa and he hits play. And now they can listen to each other's playing.
Awesome.
Right? And they can go, oh, that's supposed to be minor seven. Oh, oh, how does that hit happen? You know, and they're like working through the part, right? Now, that is really cool. One of the even cooler bits, though, is like there'll be a moment where the keys player is like, well, during the song, there's a hit here, and then there's also this chord, but I can't play both of them at the same time because, you know, it's two different patches on the same keyboard. And the MD goes, all right, cool. Well, let me just loop that section and you do the hit. And he loops it. The guy plays the hit. And since I have a board feed feeding back into it, we just recorded back into playback the new hit that he can't play.
Awesome.
So in real time, they're adding stuff and removing stuff from playback just based on how this looped setup is. And then after they kind of review it, they go just play through it again, play through it again, play through it again. And then you go, is everyone cool with it? Everyone feels good. Let's do a last pass. And that pass live streams to Korea. And the team in Korea that's the producers for the show are listening to it. And it's because the board feed that goes back into the Pro Tools rig also feeds, you know, audio movers or whatever. And they're sitting and listening to it there with no pads and, you know, going through it. It was incredible. One of the coolest things I've ever seen. But it would take them, you know, 35 minutes to learn a song from not knowing a single note to absolutely smashing it. And I was just like blown away by the musicianship for how they were doing this. It was so cool.
Awesome.
So anyway, so since then, I've actually done the same kind of setup where like the board output feeds back into the MD so that, and we were doing this on Labyrinth and a couple other things, so that if we wanted to stem things out, like if we wanted to double up the number of horns we had, I think on Labyrinth we had 6 horn players, but there were certain parts where we wanted it to feel like 12 or 16 or whatever. So we'd have them play and I'd have the stem feed into playback. Then we'd have them play again. So now we had live on top of the stem and, you know, we'd invert stereo or something like that. So it just felt like twice as many horn players. But it was so easy to do because of this routing. And it was super cool. So yeah, I learned that from K-pop and that was awesome.
I love those ideas. I love that idea. See, that's collaboration on next level because they just do things differently. You won't go to a K-pop show that's not in a stadium sold out. Like seriously.
Yeah.
And it's just them playing. Here's my favorite thing, and this is off the subject, but they'll do like an interview session before the gig and they'll just sit up there and answer questions from the audience and talk and like introduce the members. And then they leave for a bit and then they come back and rock the fucking set and people are blown away. Like I think that needs a trickle down. Like you said, and I'd love to try that on my next tour. Just those little ideas. Now I have a whole new outline in my head where I want this thing to go, you know? Amazing. Was it all time code? Did you guys just run time code over and over?
I mean, eventually, you know, they add time code to it, but like at that time it didn't make sense yet because they weren't doing video or any of the lighting stuff yet. So it was really about learning the songs, but it's kind of cool though. You go to all these different genres and there's all these weird little tricks that everyone does differently. And that was one of them where I was like, I've never done it this way before. This is cool. So I want to work on more other stuff too, where people are doing things in a, you know, air quotes, weird way so that I can learn this new weird way and see if it has value in the way I do things, you know?
No, that's awesome.
Sorry, that was a rabbit hole that, like, you know.
No, it's cool. It's fun stuff. Well, Ryan, I appreciate you hanging out with us again. It's been yes. a fun night.
Always a pleasure to chat with you guys.
Thank you.